Hi, I'm Kevin, I'm an addict. I feel a little bit nervous, but I know it's going to pass. I haven't really thought about what I'm going to share tonight at all. I always tend to attempt to go into the loo and say hello to my higher power and ask to be honest and open and carry a positive message of recovery in NA rather than my egos, you know, because the truth is I want you all to like me and think I'm wonderful and I'm just me. And it's interesting me coming up. We haven't been up the West End for ages and ages. I used to live up here. I did all my using up here. When I say live up here, I mean lived on the streets up here. And I got off of Piccadilly Circus, which is where I started using. And I went to go up, what was Subway for? It's not there anymore. The whole thing's changed. It was like, you know, I thought it'd just go down a bit of memory lane and everything's changed, you know. I got clean in 1984, I'd been using for 19 years, started in 1965, and I first started going to NA in prison. I didn't go to NA thinking it would work for me, I just went because I had nothing better to do, and it was somewhere else to go other than being yourself. And prior to going to NA, I'd done 13 rehabs, mental hospitals, whatever. You know, I'd gotten my first one in 1966 when I was 16 years old. And it wasn't that I did want to stop using those times. I did, you know. I just couldn't stay stopped. Every time I came out, I was alone. And in fact, people took me to AA in 1966. I was in this mental hospital in Southall called St. Bernard's. And in those days, there wasn't many addicts, to be honest. And I used to put this under the alcoholics. And so they used to take me to AA, and I remember thinking, wouldn't it be great if there was something like this for addicts, you know? But in those days in England, there wasn't. I'll tell you a little bit about my life before I came to AA, because I've got to talk for 40 minutes, and I can't do, well, maybe I could do 40 minutes, ago. I never tried it. So I'll tell you a little bit about how I got to AA, and then hopefully there'll be a couple of minutes left at the end, I can talk about recovery. you know, people talk about their child and all that, so I'm not going to worry about my child. I mean, I was a very resentful child, you know. I thought my parents didn't love me, they gave me dinky toys, you know. And the thing is, it's like, my parents did the best they could for me, to be honest. And there was something missing in me, you know. And it's funny, because I thought about this, like, you know, later on as I got into recovery and started looking at stuff and doing the steps and things. And I thought about, you know what? My parents did the best they could for me, and their parents did the best they could for them, and their parents probably did the best they could for them, you know, and this stuff goes back decades, you know, generations, you know. So there's no point being pissed off at your parents, really, that's the way I see it. And it's interesting, being a parent now myself, and I find myself doing some of the things that my parents used to do. You know, I want my children to have everything. I want to give them toys and all this sort of thing. You know, it's just the things that I put my parents down about. But anyway, I had this childhood. I wasn't happy anyway. Don't know why. I wanted to be free. Didn't know what freedom was. You know, but I just knew that I didn't have it. That's the way I saw it. And hated school. Hated school in the latter years. Used to play truant a lot and stuff. When I was 15 years old, I got into it was the days of mods and rockers, night in the mid-60s. And I really wanted a scooter, but I wasn't old enough to have one. I was only 15. So I used to nick them. And that was like the first thing I really got off on, was nicking scooters, you know, with the park with a bit of fur around the neck, you know. And what happened was I kept getting nicked. And I got caught three times, went to court three times in 3 months, I think it was. And on the third time, I thought, that's it, I know I'm going to get a borstal. And so I did a bunk, I jumped bail. And when I went off, and it was just the days of the beatniks, it was before hippies and stuff. And I was hitchhiking up and down the country at 15 years old. And I ended up under the pier in Brighton with these beatniks and so. And I remember actually that there was smoking dope. I didn't have any, but I remember them saying to me, the best place to get lost is in London, because there's so many people there. Because you kind of stuck out under the pier down in Brighton. And I came back to London, which is where I'm coming. But yeah, we all slept under the pier down there. And I came back to London, and I was walking down. I had no money, nothing. And I was walking down, I was in Speaker's Corner. I don't know what the fuck I was doing there. But I met this guy, got talking to him, he was a Persian guy. And he was, I remember reading something about something called Purple Hearts when I was a kid, thinking, I'm going to try not to swear because I know it's recorded. what are they? And feeling a bit fascinated, but I never. Now, when this guy had these, he said, "Look, I've got these pills," because he heard I was hanging out of all the beatniks, you see. And I got talking to him and he asked me what I've been doing and stuff. I was doing. Anyway, he said, "Look, I'll give you these pills," and this is back in the days before decimal currency, right? He said, "What you do is you sell them for a shilling. And you've got to give me sixpence back, right? I'll give you 100 of them. So tomorrow, I'll meet you up tomorrow, and you've got to give me, what would it be, £2.10 back. I think that's the sum. That's right. 100 shillings was 10 quid. Yeah. Is that, no, a fiver? Yeah, anyway. I can't even remember now. Anyway, so what happened? He said to me, but whatever you do, don't take any, right? So I went off and got these things, and I go down and see all the big, I remember it's. This pub in the West End where we used to hang out, and I took a couple, and I started talking to everyone. I'd always been a shy introvert kid, and it was just like, this is the business, you know. And of course I gave a few away because I was feeling really good. I found myself walking down the boat, walking down the Bayswater Road about 1 o'clock in the morning, talking to people. I thought, this is the business. It's a bit, that sort of thing where they say, just keep taking the medicine, keep taking the pills. And I thought, if I keep taking these, everything's going to be great. You know, I feel fantastic. It's a missing link. But somewhere along there in the middle of the night, probably about 2 in the morning, I realised I was meant to meet the guy the next day, and all I had was a quid. Because I'd taken some, given some away, you know, and there was none left. And I went down, there was an underground garage in Park Lane, and I went down and I robbed the garage to get the money to get the pills the next day. And basically, the next 19 years of my using were like that. It was getting and using and finding ways and means to get more, you know. As I said, by the time I was, I'd been locked up by the time I was 16. I was passed out of parental control. I started shooting up gear and stuff, and my parents had found it. I was on probation. I'd gone back and given myself up actually after about 3 or 4 months on the streets. And my parents had found these methadone amps and taken them around. I knew there was something wrong. I'd gone around the probation officer and I'm not going to go into it. I was dealing and stuff for a guy, you know, at this age. It was mental. But I got sent away for 3 years to what they called approved schools in those days. And when eventually I got to this approved school, because I was locked up for about 3 months before I did in this place called Ashford. When I see someone knows about it over there. When I did get there, I did a bunk after about 6 weeks, and I was back down using again. I got a smack out of it. And when they caught me again, right, about 11 months later, they didn't know what to do. They wouldn't take you back in the approved school because I had a habit. And I got sectioned into this mental hospital I mentioned earlier in St. Bernard's. I think probably then I didn't want to stop using. I was having a good time, you know, I was still working. But I was in there 5 months, came out, straight back up the West End using again. And about 3 months later, I checked myself back in of my own free will, not on a section or nothing, because I was fucked, you know. And I knew I was fucked. And there was no, am I an addict? I knew I was an addict, you know. Thinking back on my using, you know, I mean, most of it was just incredibly sad, you know. Most of that time, I was living on the streets, or I was just dusting in places, or whatever. I used to stay, there was a hostel up there, and, you know, I mean, this is a shelter for homeless people, I believe. You know, I mean, I used to live in one just around the corner there, you know. You know, the guy you see sitting on the street with a can of beer, that was me, you know, for fucking 19 years, you know. It was just a mess. It's just sad, actually. Sometimes I've recently I started remembering things from my using, you know, I just feel like crying sometimes, to be honest. Because it was sad. It wasn't exciting or anything, it was just desperation. It was like desperation and the fucking hopelessness of it all. You know, I think the worst thing about my using was, like, no matter what I did, whether I was in prison or in rehab or wherever, it's like, it was pointless. It's like, I kind of knew when I went in there, that even when I leave here, despite my good intentions, I'm going to go back to using again. I'd always done it before. You know, I'd given up on myself. And then, to be honest, they'd all given up on me as well. You know, it's like, whenever I was in prison, I'd try to get into a rehab or whatever, they'd just say, what's different this time, Kevin? And I couldn't tell them, you know. And what changed for me was, I'll just tell you, I remember a few things from my using that I've always hung on to, because I think it's good to remember the reality of your using, you know. And I got married one time. I tell you what happened was, I got married one time, and my wife was 17, I think, and I was 24. And my wife died at, I think, 22 of this disease, you know. And it was, I don't know, sorry, I've gone off track here, I've kind of got a bit emotional. I'll go back there later. What happened to me was, in 1984, I got sent to prison again. I've done about 5 years in prison over the years. Prison kept me alive, to be honest. It did. I'm grateful, actually, in retrospect. I wasn't grateful when I got sent down. I was the last time, actually, to be honest. The last time I went to prison, it was a relief, because I just knew I couldn't cut it out here anymore. I'd ulcerated legs, had for years and years. I'd spent the last 5 years I'm using on crutches or a wheelchair, hobbling around up here, you know. And when it rained, it was fucking agony, because I had holes in my shoes, you know, and it's like my feet got wet, my ulcers got wet, and I was in, I mean, something I couldn't fucking walk. And when I went away, I knew it was the right place to be. And I went away, and I was very fortunate. I got sent to the Scrubs, and there was an African doctor there. You know, and I'd had these ulcers for a long, 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 long time, years and years and years, and I'd been in hospitals here and there again. And this African doctor said, we have a lot of this in our country. I know just what to do with them. And this is a prison doctor, and I'm really grateful to him, because he got my ulcers started to heal when I was in there. And but the thing that really happened to me in there was, I remember one night, and I was really, really sick as well when I was in there, and I was in the hospital. And this one night, I was detoxing, this prison officer came round, 2 a.m, and there was these holes in the cell door, and he gave me this medicine through the cell door, and he said to me, "You know what, lad," he said, "you never have to go through this again." He was an orphan. "You never have to go through this again unless you want to." And I thought, you just don't understand that when I leave here, I will, because despite all my good intentions, that magnet will just pull me back to the West End and use it again. And the thing was, actually, I've heard that so many times, you know, you never have to do this unless you want to, you know, in recovery. And I wonder if it's in another fellowship, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, the thing that happened to me in there, the greatest thing of all that happened to me in that prison, funny enough, there was a guy called Jimmy, right, who I knew on the street, and he was in the Scrubs at the same time as well. I wonder what happened to him, and I bumped into him in there. And he said to me, "Kevin," he said, "is this NA meeting here? You've got to go to it, it's great," right? And I said, "All right, Jimmy," and I went, you know. And that was like the bestest thing I've done in my whole life. It turned my whole life around. And when I went, I didn't think it would. I didn't realise it was going to have that effect on me. In fact, you know what, I don't remember. My clean time birthday, I set at 30th November 1984, because I know I'd started going to NA then, right? But I don't remember, because when I went to NA, I didn't think I was going to stay clean. I didn't take any notice, you know. It's just like, it was just another day. And I went to the meeting, and someone came along and can't take the meeting. It was an Australian guy called Wayne, and he was a biker. And he came and he told his story, and he was crazy, if not more crazy than I was, you know. And he was clean, and he was 18 months clean. Long time in those days, 18 months clean. And the amazing thing about him was, he'd taken the time to come up to the prison to tell us about NA. And that's what really, really impressed me, you know. Because all the time, all those 5 years in prison, I don't know how many visits I had. All I was interested in, people bring out gear, actually. But people off of addicts come up to visit in prison. Maybe 5 years, I might have had 4 or 5 visits, that's all. And anyway, this guy had come up, and he's, you know, and he's, the thing that amazed me as well is, he seemed to be happy. I mean, like, the idea of being off of gear and being happy was like, you know, I mean, maybe you might be able to stay clean, but be happy, forget it, you know, you're going to be miserable. And anyway, he told us his story, and I was impressed. And he said some very basic things that I've always remembered. And he said, the first one does the damage. If you don't pick up the first one, you won't get loaded. He said, it's just for today. And if you can't do a day, do an hour. If you can't do an hour, do 10 minutes, right? And reach out to somebody else. And just those simple things, like little slogans that stuck in my mind. And I went, sat in the sun, didn't say nothing. And next meeting I went again. And I made a decision quite early on, because it's interesting, you know, we talk about the steps and stuff, and I think I was kind of, there was something happening to me where I was kind of internalising the steps before I even realised it. What actually happened to me in the prison was I had two lots of charges, and I'd managed to smuggle a syringe in on my second court case. And I had what we called an outfit then, a syringe in the nick. And in those days, well, it's probably the same now, if you had the outfit, all the gear came through you, because everyone wanted to borrow it off you, so they had to give you a taste. And after going to the NA meeting, I decided to ditch the syringe, right? And I did. And I didn't sell it to anyone, give it to anyone, I actually went and put it down the loo, you know, which is like me making a fucking decision, you know. So in fact, what happened to me in there was I went along to a meeting, and I heard the truth, you know, and they say the truth will set you free. And what the truth was that I'm powerless over my addiction. I knew that. I knew I couldn't stop. I knew every time I left before, I was just like the magnet that drew me back to the using again. It was just like, there was no way. My life is unmanageable, fucking hell. I've been homeless for fucking decades. You know, it's like, I'd lost everything, my wife, my children. You know, it's just, everything had gone. Funny, I thought, that thing about the first one does the damage. And he said, he said, alcohol's a drug. Right? And I thought, you know, he said, it's a program of total absence from all drugs. And I thought, give me a break. You've got to have something. How do you not have anything? You know, it's just ridiculous. And you've got something to chill. And I thought back about the time before when I left prison, or the time before that I left prison. I'd been in for 2.5 years or something. And I left prison. And I came out of all the good intentions in the world. And I remember, actually, I'd been in the scrubs at that time. I came out, everyone, you know, it's like, they had a party for me that day. I wasn't going to use those drugs, I was just going to use these drugs, you know. And a week later, I had a habit again. And 5 weeks later, I was back in prison, parole revoked, further charges, and thinking, how the fuck have I got back here? And what had actually happened to me was the first drink I had when I got out the gate was what set the chain off, you know. And it's like, I couldn't believe, after 2.5 years... of not using gear, well, maybe a little bit in there, but of not using gear, that I could get a physical habit again, you know, in that amount of time. And so when he told me this, and I thought about it, I thought, well, you know what, he's right. The first one did the damage, you know, it wasn't. I always used to think, if you just use for 2 or 3 days and stop, you'll be all right. I mean, you know, did I ever do that? I was never able to do that in my life, you know. I was never able to use for 2 or 3 days and stop, you know. And again, the truth set me free. So I kept going to the meetings, and it's like, what happened was I stayed clean in there. And finally, there was a guy last night, Jimmy, and was at my home group on Thursday night, and he was picking up his 26 years clean. And I'm feeling emotional about it again. You know, I got emotional. I've got become a human being in recovery, but kind of my feelings and stuff. I was just really touched by it, and I was thinking about it. He was telling me there was about 5 or 6 of us went to this meeting. There's another guy went to that meeting as well. So there's 2 of us have been clean ever since we went to that first meeting, right? And another one was at the meeting and got clean later on. So there's 3 out of the 6 of us are clean, which is something pretty amazing. The other one's got 15 years or so now as well. And I think it's just fantastic. But anyway, what happened to me was that I was going to the meetings and we were staying clean. And the way we did it was we supported each other, you know. And what happened was, you know, I think what happened was, you know, I began to internalise, I think, powerless over my addiction, my life's unmanageable, stay away from the first one, and you ain't going to get loaded. So I didn't use any gear, and I didn't have any visits that last time I was in prison at all. Not that anyone wanted to come and see me, but I wasn't taking any chances. You know, and the only people I knew were using addicts anyway. And what happened was, there was a point in time that people came up to the prison, but they couldn't get in because there was a shortage of prison staff, and we had our own meeting. And I used to do the literature in the meeting. I used to take the box of literature. It wasn't much of it, but we had pamphlets. It was very basic texts in those days. I think we had a basic text, but they were very rare in 1984 in this country. It was, you know, and because I had the literature, I used to read it, and which is a gift as well. I didn't realise it. You know, I didn't realise I was doing service or anything, but there was a benefit to it. You know, I got to read the literature. But what happened anyway? No, the people came up, couldn't get in, and we had our own meeting. And what we used to read 3 paragraphs at a time and then talk about our using, you know. But the thing about this meeting was that we all had a willingness to stay clean. And we'd gone to the meeting. It wasn't just because someone's come and bring up a smoke or something. was and cigarettes, or was a pretty girl came up or something. You know, and what I began to realise then was NA was not about them coming up to bring NA into us, that we were a part of it. You know, it was like, it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter if you're in prison or, you know, in Kalahari Desert or not, all NA meetings are is one, you know, two or more AAs getting together for a purpose of recovery, that's all. And it was like, I began to realise there was something very special here, because at the end of the meeting, I still felt good. And I used to say to my cellmate who'd been to NA far enough outside, he'd say, you're going to the NA meeting, I'd say, yeah, I'm going to get my hit for the week. Because that's all we had one meeting a week and the support of each other. And I think the thing when I threw the syringe away was I'd made a decision to go for it. It's almost like step three, you know. It's like I'd seen something that was working for me. I said that I couldn't do it on my own. I'd seen something that was working for me, and I'd made a decision to go for it by dumping the syringe. And all this is in retrospect. None of this was going on in my head at the time, you know, just thinking back over it. Anyway, let's see, I've done 25 minutes already. I've got 15 minutes. I want to get into recovery now. Well, I'm in recovery now, yeah. So, did my time in the Nick, and strangely enough, I got parole again, much to my surprise. I was only doing a year last time. I had 2 months parole. And my legs started to get better, and I had to do something in there. I started studying and stuff, because sitting around in prison doing nothing is boring. It really is boring. And funny enough, I did an O-level in there. I left school when I was 15 because I was using, right? And I did an O-level in there just off my own back. And the strangest thing is I've got an A in it, right? But I could never use it because it's got the scrubs address on it.
So I've got one O-level. Joys of recovery.
I see what happened was, like, I got parole and I didn't want to leave, to be honest, because I was scared to go out, because I knew I could stay clean in prison, but I didn't know I could stay clean outside, because I'd never been able to before, safe in there, you know, and I was homeless as well. I was going to go out to no home, you know, I mean, that's terrible. And one of the guy in there, who had been a bit of a jealous lawyer, had told me to write off, because I had bad luck, I was classed as disabled, you know, write off to the local council and ask for a council flat. And I said, no, there we go. Just do it, he said, you know. And he was a bit of a sort of lot on your case guy, and I did, and they wrote back and said, oh, we put you on a list. He said, write back again and say, that's not good enough. Under such and such an act, you've got to rehouse me because of disabled, something or other. And I did. And you know what? I didn't take the parole. Just needed to get an address, because I knew it would all be iffy, getting an address and stuff. And it was dodgy territory. And 4 weeks after I could have got out on parole, I got a letter saying that they were going to give me a council flat. And it was just like all these kind of synchronicities happened in my recovery right back from then. And eventually I had to go because my time was up. And and fortunately for me, Jimmy had got out a few weeks before me, you know. And I came out anyway. One of the guys who came up, who lived in Ladbroke Grove, Chris actually, Chris P, his name was, he's dead now, he's a lovely guy, he used to come and take the meeting. He said to me, look, I live around the corner, when you get out, give me a call. You know, this was before mobile phones, this was, you know, you had to have 5p, it was showing to put in the phone box to ring, or whatever it was, Frutons, I don't remember. But anyway, the day I got out, I was shitting myself, because it was like, everybody else gets out, they come out, the scrubs go straight down, there's a sort of grocery shop off license down underneath the bridge, they're all in there getting a can of beer. And I didn't have any good move. I went around and I had to look for a phone box around that area in Acton. It's bloody, in those days, there's no phone boxes in there anyway. In those days, they're all vandalised. I had to go and look for a phone box and find one. Eventually, I called this guy, Chris. I went around and saw him. I had a cup of tea with him and stuff. Good move. And I had to go and look at his flat. And I went and I saw his council flat, and it's bare, you know, because they don't come furnished. I'm feeling sorry for myself already. And he said, I'm going to a lunchtime meeting, I'll see you there. And I went to the meeting, and someone was doing a chair, and they talked about their phone bill, and I thought, phone bill? I never had a phone, never had anywhere to live. Junior junkies, you know, they don't know it's been like where I was. Of course they can stay clean, you know. It's like, what happens to me when I get feared up? I look for differences, you know. I try and separate myself, I'm different from everybody else. And that's exactly what's happened to me. At the end of the meeting, he said to me, go and talk to people, Kevin. I said, I can't talk to these people. And I went off up the road, it was on King's Road, Friday lunchtime, and I sat down, it was July 13th, 1985 or something, or June 13th, I don't remember, but I remember it was the 13th and it was a Friday. And I sat down outside this theatre, and all these people were sitting over there in the bistro, whatever it was they used to call them. And you know, the glasses of beer you see on the TV at the drips, you know. They all seem to have those. And I'm sitting there looking at it, and there's a thing going through my head going, yeah, there's a Shakin' Stevens or something, a song he went, you don't drink, you don't smoke, what do? You don't drink, you don't smoke, what do you do? Going round and round in my head. And I'm looking at this and thinking, that'll take the edge off, that'll take the edge off. And I remember what the guy had said. He said, first one does the damage. If you can't do a day, do an hour. If you can't do an hour, do 10 minutes and call somebody. Reach out. And that's what I did. I called Jimmy and he said, I'm going to a meeting tonight. Point your meeting. He said, how is it? I said, oh, great. I want you, to be honest, I want you back inside where it was safe, you know, with my mates. And I went to the meeting and shared it in the meeting. And the rest is history. I've been coming back ever since. And I got involved earlier on. I didn't know how to talk to people at the end of meetings. You know, I don't know how to talk to them. I used to hide myself by... I'd always been the person doing the chairs, right? Because if I was stacking chairs, I didn't have to talk to you. I didn't have to talk to anyone about anything except using. I didn't know anything about recovery or about life, you know, or football or anything. Honest to God, my life was just solely focused getting and using drugs. That's all I did, you know. And so I used to do that, and then I took on a... I remember they used to ask people to wash the cups, right? And I'd be washing the cups, and someone would be drying them, and they'd say, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I'd say, hi, I'm Kevin. And that's how I got to talk to people. I took a tea commitment, and I got to talk to people there. Everything in my life, to be honest, my socialisation, being able to talk here tonight, to be able to work, to do anything, I got my basic life skills through coming here. And I know that that's really, is it what NA is about? All NA is about, wow, it's helping them to stay clean. That's what it's about, you know, reaching out to a newcomer. I got everything from here. I was a treasurer at a meeting in Dagenham, and I learned that you put the money coming on one side, the money going out on the other. I ended up in a business where I was dealing with a lot of money, right, doing that sort of thing. You know, it's like I actually traced my... I've got no qualifications. I ended up handing millions and millions of pounds of other people's money, and they trusted me. That's the amazing thing as well. But how did I do that? I learned that through being a treasurer at a meeting. I learned to communicate here. I learned how to make tea here. You know, all these sort of things, all these life skills. I went to committee meetings, I got involved, you know, I learned, you know, I actually learned how to use a computer doing NA stuff, to be honest as well, back in, I mean, you know, personal computers weren't that like they are now, you know, but everything I've got here. My life in recovery has been fucking fantastic, you know. Of course I have days that have been painful, you know, I mean, I've had days where, you know, a relationship has ended or something, and I've hurt so much inside. My first real love in recovery was about 5 years clean, the only time I really wanted to fucking use, and I was banging my head on the fucking wall because the pain of banging my head on the wall detracted from the pain I felt inside, you know. And, you know, I mean, I always used to say I can't understand people self-harming. You know, when I got to that stage, when I got to be started to become a human being and started to feel my feelings, I knew what it felt like to fucking, why people want to self-harm. And I could do another 40 minutes. Look at the time. Yeah, I could do another 40 minutes on what's happened to me in recovery. You know, it's like I've had a sponsor basically since I got out of prison. I've had four different sponsors in the time I've been clean. They've all been wonderful people. I hate it when people say they sack the sponsor. You know, fucking, it's just, you know, it's, you know, sometimes it's time to move on, but it's like, don't get paid to do it. You know, it's like, people give you their time, which is fantastic. I chose my first sponsor because he laughed a lot. I thought it must be working for him, you know. And really simple stuff, you know. And it doesn't need to be whatever. And if it's not right, it's time to move on, you know. It's like, you find someone else. I've gone through the steps. I've got sponsors, you know, I've had sponsors, I've got sponsees. Still got sponsees. And I've been married twice in recovery. Buried both my parents in recovery. I've died twice. I've had cardiac arrest twice in recovery. Had a motorbike accident, and about 14 years clean. I'll tell you what. The thing about being an addict. I mean, I've been very lucky in recovery. I think of that accident actually as a real learning. A lot of my adversities in life have been real bonuses for me. There have been chances to move on and to learn and to change. You know, it's like I think. Yeah, I'll just tell you. How much longer have I got? Okay, I've got really
10 minutes.
Good. Okay. I had this motorbike accident, right, and and when you're dying, it's like, I was in this hospital, and I'll tell you, I can't believe how many people were there. It was just, they thought I was a sort of celebrity or something, all these LA people come up to him in intensive care and they can't get him out. You know, it's like mental. And my sponsor was there, and I think at this point in time I'd already had 2 cardiac arrests, and I had all this internal bleeding. I was all smashed up, my leg was smashed up and stuff. And my sponsor was there, and they came over and they said to me, look, we're going to take this out of hospital because we think what's happened is you ruptured this around the heart. That's why all this blood's going into your lungs and why you keep having cardiac arrest. But he said, all this equipment, because I was attached to a lot of equipment, it's just got to go with you in the ambulance. And there's a registrar or something coming with you, and the nurses are coming with you and everything. But we need to tell you, you might not make it, right? You might not make it from this hospital to the next one. You know, and it's great because I called my sponsor over, and you know what? I have always thought when you're on death's doorbed, you'd be terrified, you know. And I was there on death's doorbed, just feeling okay. I thought back over my life, and I just thought, you know, the past 14 years I've been in recovery, I actually feel I've put positive input into the world, and I felt at peace with myself, and I thought maybe it's just time to move on, you know. And I called my sponsor over, and I said, look, you know, I might not make it, but if I don't, like, I know people would be unhappy, be sad that I've died, but the past 14 years have been a bonus. You know, I never expected to get a few years out of this. I thought physically my condition was such that I would die. And here I am. Well, not, you know, I'm now 25 years clean. But it's like back then, it was like this has been a bonus. You know, I should have been dead years ago. And as you know, I didn't die. I survived. But you know, the reason I tell you that is because, you know what, I think the biggest fear of all has got to be dying, right? We all fear dying and getting run over, whatever. And you know what, every time one of the great gifts out of the accident gave me was just the thinking, every time you end a relationship or you move or you quit your job and you move on to the next thing, it's always like a little death, you know? And the truth, and I've been so gifted in being in that situation and not being scared that I can say to myself, you know what, this is just time to move on. You know, it's just time to move on, and it's going to be okay. If you can be on death's doorbed and not be scared, it's not like that all the time. I still get fear, of course I do, but it's like it was a fucking gift, because that's all it is. It's just like a little death and time to move on, and every time I have moved on, it's been better than it was before. Every one of those relationships, I haven't had that many, but I've had a few. You know, every time they've ended, and I thought, oh God, there'll never be another one like it. There's always been, I'm not saying it's better, it's been different. You know, it's been a whole new experience. You know, a lot of my problems is my thinking, you know, to be honest. I'll just tell another little story. Well, I see some people identify that. Just tell you a little story. My home group, Thursday night, Portobello Road. Right, we used to go up from there to a place up in Portobello Road, at the top of the road, called, I think it's called Portobello Cafe, and there was a little girl in there, a very sweet little thing. And she was Australian, she was bubbly and stuff. I got to know her name, she got to know mine. And one day she was talking about flowers and said, oh, she's really loved these things called gerbers and all of them. Right, so she's only young, and I'm 40 odd at the time, by the way. And I thought, okay, next week I'm going to get some gerbers. So I went off to get these flowers. Couldn't find them in the first flower shop, so I've got a bunch of something else, right? And then I looked at another flower shop, and they'd had them. So I ended up all these flowers in my car, right? So I thought, I'm arranged to meet a sponsee in his cafe before the meeting. So I got there, got the flowers in the car, the sponsee's in there, and I'm just like, my head's gone anyway, because I'm going to give this girl a bunch of flowers, you know? And sponsee says, what's going on? And I said, oh, yeah. I told him, he said, look, I'm out of here. Right, he's gone. So he's gone and left me on my own. Right? There's her and her mates in the back of the cafe. He comes over and starts talking. Oh, I said, hi, Ro. My name is Ro. So I've got somebody in the car. Go and give her the flowers in the car. She said, oh, Kevin, thank you. She said, what's that for? And I went, And I just said, because you're so happy. And it's just like, I just thought, oh God, you're such a wank. It's like, oh God, you know, you're 40 odd years old, you can't even give a girl a bunch of flowers without seizing up, you're absolutely useless, you know. And she said, you're coming back in. I said, no, I've got to go. So I go off, the meeting's there, I'm sitting in the meeting for half an hour, my head's going, oh, you're bloody useless. I thought, how many years are you in recovery? 10 years, whatever, and then you can't even get a bunch of flowers. And then I had a flash of sanity, you know, because that's what happens. So what recovery's given me, from time to time I get that flash of sanity where you get a bit of sane thinking in there, and the sane thinking said, hang on a minute, mate, you're 44 years old, she's 22 or something, or 28, you've had the courage to go and give her a bunch of flowers. Wicked. Respect, you know? Anyway, we did go out for about 2 weeks. Didn't work out, but. You listen to that stuff in your head. It's just so much rubbish, isn't it? You know, it goes on there. It tells you about good enough for us. Unfortunately, I don't get that anywhere near what I used to. I do sometimes. Everyone has bad hair days. You get up and you look in the mirror and think, well, I am getting old now, you know. And it's, I used to do it. Anyway. I used to look in the mirror and go, looking good, Kev, to try and give myself positive. I don't do it anymore. Maybe I should. But my life now is nothing like it was when I came in. I haven't been homeless since I've been in recovery. I haven't been arrested since I've been in recovery. I've been in lots of prisons, but only to do H&I meetings. You know, and strangely enough, I've started getting claustrophobic and having. And the last meeting I went to do in Brixton Prison, which I spent a lot of time in, I went in and it was terrible. I went to do this H&I meeting and I started having a panic attack in this double cell. And I managed to get through it and I just thought, well, that's a change. I can never do bird again. I've got to be a really good boy for that one. One more incentive. But all the things that I thought were going to be terrible, that were going to be real, because I've been in recovery and I've tried to do the right thing. And I mean that. I believe my goal in recovery, I heard a guy called Pepe, who's dead now as well, bless him, a wonderful guy, and I met him once, and he had this saying. He said, what's God's will for me? We talk about what's God's will for me, and he said he concluded that God's will for him was simply that he had peace of mind. You know. And so what I do in my day is I try and do things that give me peace of mind. You know. And if I do those, I feel I'm in recovery. If I do things that are a little bit dodgy or whatever, and I don't have peace of mind, that's not what I'm here for. I think that this is, you know, you say it's a spiritual program. I think the word inspired means to be in spirit. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're painting the ceiling and you're thinking, wicked, this is great, I think that's being in spirit. And that's where I aim to be in my life, to do things that make me feel, this is great. And I've had, you know, very well paid jobs. Right now I'm working for myself doing, never mind what I'm doing. But it's like, and I've left them and gone to live in countries where there's abject poverty and just changed my whole life and everything in recovery. Right, I've taken the risk and done it, you know. And I think that life is short, you know. I think we're all incredibly talented and gifted people. We've all got God-given talents, you know, me included, you know. And I think that it's kind of an insult to God, whatever you perceive God to be, not to use your God-given talents, you know. And I don't think that any of us are meant to be here. You know, I'm given a kind of thing. This is my stuff. I don't think anyone are meant to be here to live a drudge of a life. And I think that we can all do great things, you know. And I see that day after day after day in people. I mean, I love seeing people come in and say, I've got a day clean. And I see them at 30 days and whatever, you know. And it's just, the whole life's changed around here. It's just fantastic what we've got going here. There's nothing like it. Look at that. I think I might run out of time. I still love recovery. I've still got a home. I've got 2 meetings a week, I'll be honest with you. I've got a family. I'm 60 years old now. God, I've got a 16-month-old baby who is just fantastic, you know. I love my wife. You know, anyway, it's just, I've got a life beyond my dreams. I never had any dreams when I came here. You know, I couldn't see beyond, you know, maybe one day having a pair of shoes that didn't have a hole in them. Well, my ulcer's getting better. You know, my life is, it's just beyond my wildest dreams. And I need to remember that. I just close on one last thing. You know, people used to talk about pink clouds, you know, and I think that for me what happened when I came in, I think actually that stuff about you come in, you get clean, you're on a pink cloud, I think that's the reality. You know, what happens further on down the line for me, certainly at periods of time, is my life has got complicated and I forgot the simple truth. The fact that I'm clean today is a fucking miracle. The fact that I've got all this good stuff in my life today is a fucking miracle. You know, that is, if that's a pink cloud, fucking so be it. When I'm in that space of like, oh God, you know, I didn't earn this much money, or whatever, you know, all the stuff I've got in my life, you know, it's like I'm denying the reality of where, you know, of the gift that I've got. You know, life in itself is a gift. That's because of where I've been, and that's why I know that, you know, and I love it, and I don't want to die anymore. And which is what I wanted to do when I was using. I want to live, you know, and I try to do that as best I can. Some days better than others, but overall that's where I want to be. I'll leave it there. Thanks for listening.